The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 8.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Well, folks, I'm glad to introduce to you David R. Henderson. He's a great economist, also a personal friend, and I've known David for years, and I think you'll see in this interview what an interesting guy he is, and that he's gotten into a lot of different areas. He's not just in academia, but he also was on the Council of Economic Advisors. We get into some stories involving a certain Keynesian economist who wrote for the New York Times. So that stuff is going to be fun. Don't make sure you don't miss that. Before I give the formal introduction, though, to David, let me just mention something, some housekeeping. If you tuned into the previous episode, bobmurphyshow.com/7, you know that I went over the proof for Gödel's theorem. It occurred to me there's a slight possible ambiguity there. So very quickly, let me just make sure nobody is confused. To try to motivate it, I was saying things like, there are true mathematical statements that we can never prove. And that might have led you to believe that there's this statement out there about numbers and humans will never be able to prove that it's true, even though it may in fact be true. That's actually not quite it. I think it's more correct to say what Gödel showed is that if you try to specify any axiomatic framework with which you then try to prove all the true mathematical propositions, you're always going to fail. No matter how you specify the framework within that system, there will always exist true statements about numbers that cannot be proven within that particular system. But if you augment the axioms, or you choose a different set of axioms and try to tackle math that way, then a particular true statement about numbers that you couldn't prove with the one axiomatic framework, you might be able to prove with this one. Okay, so it's not the same set of propositions that are always eluding proof from the axioms, regardless of the framework. The point, though, is simply that once you specify a particular framework and say, okay, I got it, now we're going to go ahead and prove all the mathematical truths with these particular axioms, nope, that's never going to work. There will always exist true statements about numbers that you can't prove with those particular axioms. So I think it's more showing the limits of an axiomatic foundation. It's not necessarily saying that, oh, there's these true statements about numbers out there that, geez, we just never know. It's on the one hand, it's deeper and yet maybe not as significant as you thought originally, depending on. So it's more about the limits of a particular approach to trying to codify knowledge. Okay, well, now that I've given you that sort of warm-up, we'll go into David Henderson's interview. His official bio, let me read it for you here. David R. Henderson is an emeritus professor of economics at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and a research fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He was previously a senior economist for health policy and for energy policy with President Reagan's Council of Economic Advisors. Dave is the editor of the Concise Encyclopedia of Economics, the only reader-friendly encyclopedia of economics, and he's also the author of The Joy of Freedom, An Economist's Odyssey, and he's also a co-author on Making Great Decisions in Business and Life. And of course, we're going to have links to all this stuff at the show notes page. Again, this is bobmurphyshow.com/8. Additionally, David's written over 300 articles for such popular publications as the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Barron's, Fortune, Los Angeles Times, Washington Post, USA Today, Chicago Tribune, National Review, and Reason. David's also testified before the House Ways and Means Committee, the Senate Armed Services Committee, and the Senate Committee on Labor and Human Resources. He's also appeared on C-SPAN, CNN, the Jim Lehrer NewsHour, the John Stossel Show, the O'Reilly Factor, MSNBC, RT, NPR, CBC, and the BBC. Born and raised in Canada, he moved to the United States in 1972 to earn his PhD in economics at UCLA, and David proudly became a U.S. citizen in April 1986. Without further ado, here's my conversation with David R. Henderson. Well, hello, David. Thanks for joining me for this, the eighth episode of The Bob Murphy Show.
Well, thank you, Bob. I'm really looking forward to this.
So let me go down the normal path that I do with economists that I'm sure many of my listeners already know about and just ask you about your background. So at what point did you know that you wanted to, did you think of it as like, I want to be a college professor, or how did that happen?
Well, I think I have to start by talking about how I got hooked on economics, because I didn't, still, even being a college professor seemed pretty ambitious for me. But it was my last year at the University of Winnipeg. I'd been a math major. I'd started at the University of Winnipeg at age 16 because my birthday was in November. I got into school just under the wire in first grade. And then I was so bored that my parents had me skip a grade. So I graduated at age 16. It was a three-year degree in Canada. So I was about to graduate at age 19. When I was 18, I was arguing with a calculus professor. I was a math major, and I argued at length. I was reading Ayn Rand. I was reading her nonfiction as well as her fiction. I was starting to read Hayek. I was starting to read Milton Friedman. And I just found those, and they were talking about things I'd literally never thought about. And maybe that was, I was kind of a blank slate, but you know, open to it. Well, that's what I guess a blank slate is. And I was just stunned by just how much sense it made. And I remember walking around the apartment, small apartment we had in Winnipeg, and reading big sections of Milton Friedman's section on occupational licensure where he talked about doctors and the AMA, and reading it. I can't say I read it to my mother. I'd have to say I read it at my mother because she wasn't that interested, but I was just that hooked on it. And I spent $7 to order from the Hudson's Bay Company a brand new copy of Capitalism and Freedom. And $7 for a college student, I was literally paying my own way through college. I had gone up and worked in a mine in northern Canada when I was 18 to pay for my last year of college. Anyway, back to this math professor. He was a very honest socialist. And he said, look, David, you've actually beat me in this argument. Like, what you're saying, I don't have a good answer for. But this is an economics argument. I'm a calculus professor. If your arguments are good, why don't you take them to the econ department and see what they say? And I thought, you know, he's absolutely right. So my last year of college, I took a course in Canada, or at least in that school. It was a year-long course, all the courses were, in economics, introductory economics, with a textbook by Samuelson and Scott. Anthony Scott was the Canadian author for the Canadian content in the textbook. And halfway through the year, say December, we had done all the macro, and I said, whatever else I know in life, I know I don't want to be an economist. And that same month, December of 69, my mother died of cancer. And she left my sister, brother, and me a $10,000 life insurance policy and some modest retirement assets. So we had about $6,000 each. And I started taking pilot lessons. I'd had this dream of being around airports or airplanes. I'd always loved that idea. And I'd flown at that point once in my life. And I started taking pilot lessons. But then our Libertarian Club tried to get Milton Friedman to come to our campus and speak. We couldn't afford him with the little grant we had from the college and another grant from the Intercollegiate Studies Institute in the United States. But the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, ISI, recommended a guy we'd never heard of, Harold Demsetz. And the way they described him, if you go two steps to the right of Milton Friedman, you'll trip over Harold Demsetz. So we invited him, and we spent our whole annual budget on his transportation, hotel, and fee. And I still remember his speaker's fee for three speeches was $600, which he said later, I thought you guys had bargained.
Oh, that was his opening offer?
He didn't understand we were Canadians. We were Canadian kids. It didn't even occur to us to bargain. So anyway, I went to three talks he gave, and it just opened my eyes about what you could do with economics. One of them was how you can solve certain pollution problems with private property. Another one was how free markets put a cost on racial discrimination and therefore make less of it than if you didn't have free markets and things like that. And it was just wow, you know, all these things that I'd either not read about or maybe read, but just, I didn't know you could be at a major university and say these things. And so when we took him back to the airport in Winnipeg to go back to Chicago, he said to me, he turned to me and said, you should come down to Chicago and get a PhD in business or a PhD in economics. And I said, I'd never had someone like at that level say that kind of implicitly good thing about me. And I said, the honest reaction, I said, I don't know if I'm good enough. And Harold said, you're good enough. And I learned later, seeing how he taught to other people, that that wasn't just a lie. You know, he said, so some people, you're not. And
so how did he, I mean, had he had a lot of conversation with you during his visit? Well, I mean, just how did he know?
Good question. We'd gone to every meal with him. And I was asking him all these questions, like, how do you handle natural monopolies and all this stuff? Read my article, Why Regulate Utilities, you know, stuff like that. And all these questions. So we were at lunches and dinners with him, even one breakfast. We talked to him before his talk. We talked to him after the talk. And he just had an impression of me, you know? And so that's, I immediately canceled my pilot lessons and decided to save money towards graduate school. And I don't know, by the way, you stop me if you think this is too much detail to answer one question. So, you know, should I keep going?
Oh, yeah, keep going.
Okay, okay. The economics professor I had just wasn't open to these ideas. I had a sense I might be embarrassing him with tough questions in class when I was taking him on. I figured that out pretty quickly. So I went to his office just one-on-one, so there was no face-saving issue. And he was just as close. So that was like, I saw a contrast right there between this kind of Keynesian with a socialist bent and someone like Harold Demsetz. I mean, the way people questioned him and really came on the attack and the way he handled it without getting mad. I mean, that was a nice little modeling of behavior also, you know? And by the way, somewhere in my attic, I still have the tapes. I recorded every one of his talks.
So can I stop you for a second? So
it
wasn't that he was just speaking to a friendly crowd. Like a lot of people from the university showed up and were...
Yeah, so our Libertarian Club was a very active club on campus. And we were, I think we were respected the way people respect rattlesnakes rather, you know, but still we were respected. And so we'd have-
They didn't tread on you.
Yeah, right. we'd have maybe 10 libertarians show up from campus, another five from the University of Manitoba, a couple of objectivists from our objectivist group. So maybe like 15 max of people who were friendly, and then 30 to 50 people who were just interested or really hostile. So this one guy, Art Ross, whose father was literally a member of the Communist Party, and he seemed to be following in his father's footsteps. So I remember Harold commented on this later that when I went down and visited him at Chicago, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but he took me to lunch with his colleagues and he was telling them about our group. And he said, when someone would ask a question, Clancy Smith, who was my mentor and the head of the group, would hold up a piece of paper, communist or socialist or liberal, kind of telling him where the guy was coming from. So he kind of was ready.
Oh, okay.
It was not a friendly audience, but of course this was 1970. So it wasn't like people chanting either. It was people listening respectfully and then maybe having a little attitude in their question, but still, you know, within the bounds, really. So, yeah.
Because you said a comment a minute ago that I just wanted to follow up on, that you said something like you didn't know someone could say those things at a college campus. So that was, you obviously were aware of the ideas because you've been reading Milton Friedman's stuff. But I guess partly I'm guessing now what you meant was that he was able to handle himself and say things that were quite provocative to that crowd. And yet, it wasn't like he just got trounced and, you know, that he was able to hold his ground and so forth.
Right. And the thing is, I'd been saying those things on campus. Clancy had been saying those things on campus. I was starting to get enough nerve to say them in actual classes. But what I hadn't seen was any professor there who said those things. So do those people exist? I mean, I knew some of Murray's work. I didn't know Murray. I knew some of Murray's work, and he was at Brooklyn Polytechnic, which I knew wasn't a great school. But to find out that you could be at what's thought of as one of the best schools in the world and say these things was striking. And I thought, well, sure, Milton Friedman can say it. He's got this incredible reputation. But here's this guy I'd never heard of, Harold Demsetz, who's saying it also. And then when I looked around, I was going to say I went online and looked at his vita, but that didn't happen.
Right.
Somehow I found out more about him. And some, well, he quoted some of his articles from the Quarterly Journal of Economics, the Journal of Law and Economics. I'm thinking, this guy's a player. You know, and so that was just eye-opening to me. So I asked this other more friendly free market economist who I'd never had in a class named Sylvester Damus. He was an Argentinian who'd been a Friedman and Harberger student. And he said, I said, look, I should take a year of economics before I do this, like advanced undergrad, maybe one grad course. What's a good school to go to do that? And he said the best one in Canada, of course, because Canadian schools were heavily subsidized, was University of Western Ontario. So I applied, and I wasn't asking for money or anything. I was just asking to go there and study for a year and not get a degree. So, of course, they accepted me. And then I went on this long trip. I graduated, went down to Chicago, visited Harold Demsetz. He took me to lunch, knocked on Milton Friedman's door. He gave me about 10 minutes with two pieces of advice. There's a bigger world out there besides Ayn Rand, which I'd known, and make politics an avocation, not a vocation. And a lot of young people I've talked to who are my generation got the same advice from Milton. So I hitchhiked.
I think I know what he means by that, but since we're going through this, why don't you expound on that? I mean, what exactly did he mean by that?
He said, I learned later what he meant because he expanded on it as I got to know him. But I did essentially get the essence. But well, what I got later is why. First of all, you know, do good work and don't be highly political. That's what he meant. And then the question is why. And later on, as I got to know him, he explained his worry was that you get corrupted. That, you know, if you really get into politics, what do when you don't get elected or you fear not getting elected? You change your views. Or what do you do if you aren't even in political office, but you're advising them? You know, you advocate all kinds of compromises or you just those kinds of things. And he saw it as a kind of an intellectual dead end. And those are my words, but that's kind of what I got of him. At best, an intellectual dead end and maybe an ethical dead end.
Okay, so, but just for clarification, so did he mean just merely advising political officials or being the Treasury Secretary or something? Or did he mean even less formally that you don't want to be writing in favor of one party or the other?
He thought you could advise political officials, witness the fact that he did. He'd worked closely with Goldwater in the 64 campaign. So it wasn't that. It was that he had his independent place to be. So if things didn't go his way, he wasn't going to lose a paycheck, and therefore he could afford to easily to stick to his principles. I think that's what he would say.
Okay.
Yeah. So I get back to Winnipeg, hitchhiked out in late May, hitchhike out to the Vancouver and down to LA. By the way, that's when I first met Dana Rohrabacher back then. And visited relatives in Western Canada and friends and various libertarians whom I'd heard of. And it was about a 5 or 6 week trip. And then I got back in early July and found out that my brother had committed suicide.
Oh.
And yeah. And I was just, we were close, and I was just not wanting to go to the University of Western Ontario anymore. I had a network, I had a group of friends, most of whom were pretty supportive about that. And I just thought I want to be around them. So one of my friends I was close to, he and I got an apartment together. And I did what Harold Demsetz, and I contacted the University of Western Ontario and said, here's what happened. Can I delay by a year? And they said, sure. And Harold had said, get every back issue of the Journal of Law and Economics and work your way through it. And I thought, well, that's good advice. So I had a whole year to do that. And I would just get up, have breakfast, and from about 8 in the morning till noon every day, read the Journal of Law and Economics, work my way through it, follow up footnotes. I discovered public choice from a footnote. I mean, that's where I came across Buchanan and Tulloch's Calculus of Consent. And I went to the library, got that book, read it all through. And I read Anthony Downs in Economic Theory of Democracy. And I just got into so many things. And there was one day I was reading an article by Ward Bowman in the Journal of Law and Economics on patent exploitation. And he was talking about licensing of patents. And he had this line, I'm sure you've seen it many times, where economists, and he was, yeah, he was a law professor, but he was also clearly an economist, where they'll say things like, obviously, and it's not obvious to you at all. And so he had one of those obviously lines. He had a graph, a supply and demand, and obviously this is true. And I thought, wow, that's not obvious. So I took his graph, I figured out how I would show it. I took some tracing paper. I don't know if your audience has heard of tracing paper, but anyway, I put it on the thing with little paper clips and I drew, okay, well, if it's a per unit license, then you shift the demand curve down by this amount and you do this, do that, solve for the new equilibrium. Oh, okay. Wasn't obvious, but he's right. And then I turn the page and the next page has the exact graph I had just drawn. And I went, oh my God, I'm getting this. Like, I am understanding this. That was one of those moments where it was a really big moment for me. So I went to University of Western Ontario and did well there, learned a ton, really felt like I was ready. And so around November, I called up Demsetz. Meanwhile, he'd moved to UCLA. Mm-hmm. And I said, Professor Demsetz, you remember you said, you think I'd be really good in this program. And he goes, remind me who you are again.
I talk to a lot of young men.
And so I told him, oh, yes, yes. And he said, you're not Clancy, because it turned out the one who most impressed him was Clancy, which I can see why. And then I said something. I explained that I'd like him to recommend me. He said, well, I can write a recommendation. Unfortunately, I don't know you really well. And I said, oh, yeah. He said, well, he says, there's a solution when people don't know things. I said, what's that? He says, information. He says, write me about yourself. So I took about 12 hours. I wish I still had that letter. I used carbon copy, but I don't have it anywhere. And I wrote him just my view of how I'd gotten into economics, what I'd done, what I wanted to do. And I don't mean the way probably Paul Romer did it, like, I want to show growth. Or it was just more like, I want to be out in the world pushing these pro-free market ideas, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's a very kind of activist letter in that sense. And I sent it to him. And I said, so if I write a letter and you just are impressed, you know, well, I know, I said, I'd heard from someone at Western Ontario that there might have been some little tension or whatever between him and Chicago, and that's why I went to UCLA. So I said to him, because I wanted a letter not just to UCLA, but to Chicago. And I said, how much weight will they put on your letter? And that was a risky thing to ask. And fortunately, he misunderstood because he said, you mean how strong a letter will I make it? And I went, yeah.
Right.
And so anyway, I never saw his letter, of course, but I think it was pretty strong. And Armin Elchin, and again, I don't have this letter, but Armin Elchin a few weeks later wrote me a letter explaining why I should come to UCLA. And I went, oh my goodness, like no one's wanted me in my life. You know, mm-hmm. It was amazing. And then a couple of months later, I was pulled out of a class. A professor at Western had a note that I should call Clay LaForce, who was the chairman of the econ department. And they made me an offer. He made me a great offer over the phone. Full tuition, including out-of-state tuition, $440 a month for 9 months being a teaching assistant. And like, this was money I'd never heard of, right? And I really knew how to live within a tight budget. I'd been financially on my own since age 16. So I, you know, Chicago came through with an offer, but it was just tuition. There was no extra money. Oh, and I applied at VPI, now Virginia Tech, where Buchanan and Tulloch were. Mm-hmm. I'd met Tulloch the fall of 71, and I asked him for a recommendation, and he wrote back a letter. This is so Tulloch. Well, I wrote a recommendation. Of course, I made it a stronger recommendation for our school than for the others. And what I'd done when I went through the JLE was I wrote down, the names of people whose articles really impressed me and what school they were at. And the things that kept coming up were UCLA, Chicago, VPI, Virginia, and occasionally Duke. And I applied at all five and got in. But the best offer by far was UCLA. And for this kid who grew up in 20 below, you know, going down to LA, it's like, oh my goodness, that's like Shangri-La.
Sure.
You know, so it was not a hard choice. And it's still, by the way, a choice I didn't regret. I don't regret. Like, I think, well, I have one little regret, I'll say in a minute, but I think I learned more economics there because of my particular interests than I would have learned at Chicago. That's what I think. Who knows? My regret is one thing that UCLA was not good at, and Buchanan, when I was talking to him once, referred to this as the UCLA disease, is they don't know how to mentor their students. They don't really encourage them. Once, you know, you see something in the AER and you write a critique of it and you show it to them, and they go, eh, you know. And Buchanan would have said, good for you, you know, here's what you do next and all that stuff. So he was amazing in that direction. And in fact, when I wrote him a fan letter during that year off, he wrote me back within a week, and I'd asked him a question about one particular section. And I said, this is two possible meanings, which is, and he said, which one it was. And then he said, by the way, you could take that appendix, a bunch of us were talking the other day, you could take that appendix and update the numbers and you might get a note in the National Tax Journal. So here's this guy who doesn't know me from Adam mentoring this 20-year-old, you know. And by the way, I should have taken his advice. I didn't. But I would have maybe had a National Tax Journal note by the time I was 21, you know. So it's just a huge difference. But anyway, I remember one thing Harold told me, which was worth a mint. I said, well, I'm thinking of applying. I'm not sure whether to apply to the master's or PhD. And Harold says, PhD. And I said, why? He goes, because if you apply to a master's, they put you in one pile, the pile that doesn't get money, no matter how good you are. You know, mm-hmm. And he said, you can always change your mind and not go full PhD. So that made sense. So I did that. And it was really in my second year where I said, well, I've got to do something for a living. And so this whole gets back to being a college professor. I think I'm going to be a college professor. So I am going to go for my PhD. And so that's how I got into it.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, was there anything like the GRE back then?
There was. So I'm glad you asked that. I took the GRE in December of 71 at University of Western Ontario. I knew I'd done really well on the quant and the verbal in the morning. It's a 3-hour, 1.5 hours on each. And it turned out I got 99th percentile in the quant and 91st percentile in the verbal, or whatever they called it. In the afternoon, they did the econ GRE. And there were, oh man, there were all these questions like this quote and who said it. And I'd never done history of thought. And, you know, you could get docked for wrong guesses. But what I found was I could usually narrow it down out of 4 choices to 2. So then my odds were way better. But I remember at one point thinking, you know what? This isn't for me. And I started to get up and tear it up and say, I'm not going to go on in economics. And I said, that's stupid. They'll tell you that, you know, if you're no good. If you get 50th percentile, you're going to know. So I got 94th percentile. So I was really glad I didn't tear it up.
Wow. It's the number one. That's why partly why I asked you, because I was impressed you were getting all these offers from top schools just on the basis of, you know, your personal charisma or something. That they must have been some objective thing where they're like, yeah, this guy looks like a good candidate. But then also,
yeah, I think it was those things plus what I said in my letter. I mean, even mm-hmm. showing when you talk about what you want to do that you're aware of the literature.
Right.
Because when I got to UCLA, I'd run into people who were top of their class in good colleges around the country. And they say, Coase, who's that? Well, I knew who Coase was. I've been reading JLE,
right.
You know, stuff like that. Yeah.
But that is interesting that you were, I mean, were you just not used to ever getting anything wrong? I mean, it's just kind of funny the difference where you were getting ready to quit thinking that this isn't for me and you end up getting a 94 on the thing or 94th percentile.
Yeah, I was used to being so prepped mm-hmm. for any given exam in high school and college that, yeah, like I'd always go in knowing the answer.
Okay.
And so to go in and have to guess, like that was mm-hmm. new territory, you know?
Yeah, similar thing happened to me where in I was valedictorian in 8th grade and then senior in high school.
Wow.
And then in college, I wasn't valedictorian, but it was the kind of thing where like I could study the night before an exam and get 100 on the exam kind of thing. And then when I went to grad school, I went to NYU. That first year, I really thought I was going to fail out. There were two Americans in the program of our first year. And we were joking that there was going to be ethnic cleansing once we had the qualifiers, that they were going to get rid of all the Americans because we weren't good enough at math. And it was a similar thing where it turned out we were fine. It's just we were both, you know, hot shots in undergrad and we were, you know, strolling in there. And then I was like, whoa, we just were not used to, you know, playing at that level.
Yeah. And we had the same, like, I remember they did this whole orientation for a few hours for the new students. And I remember Axel Leonhoven got up and man, was that guy depressing. First, he said something like that's military. I was going to say the three D's, divorce, death. Or whatever. But anyway, it was like, basically, if you're married, there's a good chance you won't be when this is over.
Oh, he really said that?
Yeah, he said that. And I remember Harold was so outspoken. So afterwards, and I just, you know, glommed onto the good thing. Well, I wasn't married, but I glommed onto the good things and just, there were a lot of good things said. And I remember Harold said to another colleague, it might've been to Sam Peltzman and I was nearby listening, man, you know, this is a build esprit de corps thing. You don't tell them all the crap. But anyway, so, but I remember just also being impressed because I remember there was this guy, George Murphy, who got up and said why his history of thought class was good. Peltzman got up, talked about his IO class. And I went in there feeling like, hey, you know, I think I'm really ready for this. So I'm going to take an overload. So I wanted to take one field as well as the standard stuff. And the IO sounded good and the history of thought sounded good. So I went up to Demsetz at the little party afterwards, the little barbecue. And I said, wow, you know, both the Murphy thing sounded good and the Peltzman thing sounded good. I'm not sure which I should do. I want to do an overload. I'm not sure which I should do. And, you know, I'm so used to like professors in that situation saying, well, on the one hand, this, on the other hand, that. And Demsetz just goes, Peltzman. I said, what? He goes, Peltzman. Take Peltzman. So I did, and I was really glad I did because I got Sam his last year at UCLA before he went back to, you know, the mother church.
Right. And I just know him from the seatbelt. He's the guy that did the seatbelt study, right?
Yep. And the FDA study. The FDA was the earlier one. And it's like, wow, has that been important? But yeah, the next big one was the seatbelts.
So for the listeners who don't know, the seatbelt one, what I mean is that's as different states, obviously, David, correct me if I botch any of these details, but different states phased in, you know, laws requiring you to wear seatbelts if you're driving. And so that was a good sort of controlled experiment. Like you could look at, you know, two states and that were adjacent and, you know, their accident rates and things like that. And then if one of them implements the new policy, that was kind of a good way to do econometrically to assess it. And the big picture is that it depends on the specifications and all that stuff, but the general thrust, I believe, was that motorists got into more accidents, but given that you were going to be in an accident, the chance of you dying went down because you're more likely to have a seatbelt on, but that pedestrians were now in more danger because the fact that motorists are wearing seatbelts makes them drive a little bit more recklessly, but the seatbelt protects them. But the pedestrian is not helped by the fact that you're wearing a seatbelt as a driver. And
that's basically the right reasoning. The actual data was time series data. It was looking at the whole United States over time. So not looking at those state laws, so that's probably a good one. I bet someone has done that as a follow-up. It was looking at the 1966 Act that required not just seatbelts, but padded dashboards, all those things. And so he went time series to look at that and found, you know, in other words, looking over time and found that pedestrian and motorcyclist deaths went up, adjusting for everything, and that auto fatalities were constant, adjusting for everything. So, yeah.
And then what's the FDA one? I've heard of it, but I forget the details.
The FDA one was looking at the 1962 Kefauver amendments that said not only do the drug companies have to test for safety, but also they have to test for efficacy. And to test for efficacy, it has to be efficacy doing something. So you have to even specify the particular disease you want this to work on. And then that slowed down. As Sam expected, he showed that slowed down drug development substantially. And so I think he estimated that the number of new drugs relative to the trend was about 40% lower every year after that.
And what was really crazy about that, again, correct me if I'm botching these details, but that those amendments were in response to the thalidomide, right?
Yeah, which was total safety, right?
Right. So it's again,
thalidomide was to make women not have morning sickness. It was efficacious. The problem was kids were born without limbs. And so, this is, by the way, this is a common story in regulation. A couple of years later, I did my dissertation under Harold Demsetz. I looked at the coal mine safety legislation of 1966 and 69. And the big, big excuse for it was this big, big explosion that killed, I think, 125 people in West Virginia, a big mine in West Virginia. But if you look at what went wrong, it was stuff that was already regulated. So these were new regulations that even if applied, wouldn't have affected that at all. What would have affected it if they'd done it well was enforcing the existing regulations. And that's a standard story, by the way, I think, in regulation.
Yeah. Again, just for people who missed, we were going that fast. So there's the whole thalidomide scandal, and you know, obviously it was a tragedy for the people who were affected by it, where women are taking this drug that's supposed to help with morning sickness, and it ends up affecting, you know, there were birth defects in the babies for a lot of them. So clearly that's an issue of that was something that, you know, was not safe, or that there were, you know, serious hazards. And so if anything, you would say, okay, they should amend it. So to say, you know, really let's be more stringent on the safety element. Instead, it went from the FDA saying, you know, new drugs have to be shown to be safe. And of course, safe's in quotation marks, there's nothing that's truly safe. And also be efficacious. And as David's saying, this was not an issue of, oh, this thing got approved, even though they never showed that it was efficacious. That has nothing to do with it.
Right, right. And so, yeah, so Sam was huge in the profession. I think he was one of the people who got economists doing more empirical stuff. Now, Sam was not Mr. Econometrics, but so he used some pretty crude methods. This was circa 1972, 73. And yet when people, it was like Stigler, who was similar in that way, and Stigler was his mentor, when people would come along and do much more careful designs, they'd come up with similar results.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you, so while you were at UCLA, and this is something that came up when I was talking with Steve Landsberg, because he had been in Chicago and he was talking about the price theory classes that he was taking there. And I think you've blogged, I've seen like an econ log, about, you know, the price theory classes you were taking at UCLA. I think that's something fairly unique to those programs. Do you get what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
I do. And of course, I didn't know that it was unique. Right. I knew about Chicago because somehow I'd gotten my hands, when I was studying for my comprehensive, I got my hands on some price theory comprehensives from Chicago, and I was working my way through them. And so they didn't call it price theory. They called it something else. Elchin's class was the first one, but it was clearly, it was price theory plus whatever Elchin's interested in. But it wasn't one of those BS things where Elchin comes in and he wasn't prepped. He's always prepped, but he's got this kind of twinkle in his eye saying, like, I'm going to show you guys why you don't know anything. And then, you know, we'd play the game and say, well, I think it's this. And he'd say, no. And I think it's that. No. And then we'd go back to our offices and work for 2 hours figuring out why he was right and we were wrong.
Do you have any examples of something like that?
Gee. You know, it's embarrassing, but I don't.
Okay.
I do remember that sometimes when someone got the answer, he would say, no, it's wrong. And we would go back and we'd spend 2 hours and we'd say, no, so-and-so got the right answer. And we'd go back and tell him that the next day and say, yeah, I know. But I think he saw it as a really good exercise. And I think he was absolutely right to test your confidence. Like, okay, some people are going to tell you you have a wrong answer when you have a right answer. So you have to work through that too. So it was painful, by the way. It's not like I went in there the way I went into my calculus class my first year of college, where it was like this adventure. It was like, I'm going to find out how dumb I am yet again today, you know. And I remember, like, my friend Harry, who I managed to persuade them to accept into the program, coming down from Canada, Harry Watson, I remember he remembered this about Elchin, which I'd forgotten, but I think I was maybe better able to take it. I'm not sure. But he remembers Elchin telling us the first day, the purpose of this course is to separate the merely dismal from the abysmal. So that's the UCLA disease, right? Like Buchanan's like, oh, you got this idea, let's run with it. And we didn't get that. And I think, by the way, UCLA had less of an impact on the world because of that. More dropouts, more people not learning how to write an article as quickly and so on.
Now, is that partly just like personalities, or do you think that they had the mentality like, no, we're like drill sergeants and we got to get these guys into shape and, you know, we're actually helping them and we're just, you know, tough love kind of thing?
Oh, no, I think it's the latter, but I think that latter appeals to a certain kind of personality. And I think they were wrong.
Okay.
Yeah, but yeah.
It is interesting just in general how there are some people who just have dozens or even hundreds of students, you know, like that's what their career is it's not so much what papers did they do, but it's like, you can just identify, you know, in my circles, the big one that comes to mind is Walter Block. Like there just are so many people that I think of as like, oh yes, that's a Block student.
Interesting.
You know what I mean? Like that's a thing. Yes. Whereas, you know, I don't know that there's many Murphy students walking around in terms of people that directly were my students, you know, even so anyway, that's just.
No, that's right. And I'll tell you another person like that. There aren't a whole lot of Stigler students walking around. Of course, Stigler was a long time ago, but 30 years ago, there weren't a lot of Stigler students walking around. He was very hard to get a dissertation passed. And a number of my friends came out of their ABD and we were talking. I remember one of them in particular, we were talking and I said, you got all that done? And you had those four chapters? It's like, yeah, you know, and he wouldn't sign off. And like, you remember Buchanan's famous line was, don't get it right, get it written, which has its own problems, but it's a way better. I say, don't get it right, get it written, and then revise. Mm-hmm. But it's just way better than what we got at UCLA.
Yeah, I remember there was a seminar on how to write a technical paper at NYU for our PhD program. And William Baumol was the guy leading it. And I remember I looked at his CV. And it was amazing. It listed the books that he had published and then said, and over 1,000 peer-reviewed articles. Like, it didn't even list the articles. Yeah. It was like, that would just be take too much time.
Wow.
And so, you know, he was a pretty good person to have there in terms of how do you publish an article. And he did say something, it wasn't as pithy as don't get it right, get it ripped. But he did say something like, hey, when you're getting into a literature, at some point you just have to stop reading.
Yep.
That, you know, there's so much written, especially if it's a big topic, that you got to just stop and know that there's a trade-off. And there might be that one paper that, shoot, you should have read that and that would have changed your thesis or something. But you know what I mean? You got to stop somewhere.
No, that's good. That's really good. By the way, I never met Baumol, but I had a great conversation with him on the phone that was really important for a particular thing in my life. And I still like the guy just based on that.
Yeah, he was an interesting guy. He and his door at NYU, he had a cartoon, not a political cartoon, but and it showed, and it was saying something like, don't try to hold people in the mud or something, because then you got to get down there with them, or it was something like that.
Oh yeah, don't wrestle a pig, because the pig, you both get dirty, but the pig enjoys it. Something like that.
I am familiar with that one. It wasn't that. It was something else. Okay, about holding somebody under in the mud.
Yeah,
and then it just popped into my head. My first year, we went this girl who was older than us threw a party, but she was a student, threw a party, and we went to her place, and the faculty were invited. And then there are also people from Columbia there and University of Columbia. And and we're interacting. And there was an older guy. I think I could dig up his name, but I don't want to embarrass him. But he, so an NYU professor who was at this party, and he was older, and some of the Columbia students were all there. And then one guy had too much wine. He looked at him. He goes, my God, you're Baumol. And the guy had to say, no, actually, I'm not. And it was just pretty good. Anyway.
That's funny. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's pause for a moment in my conversation with David R. Henderson to talk about the stock market. As David and I were recording that particular conversation, the market was down, I think, close to 2 percentage points, and that was following a day, there was a break, a day of mourning, but before that, the market was down something like 3% as well, and of course, that's following on a brutal October. And I haven't focused on it so much here on the Bob Murphy Show, partly because I wanted to get into new things, but I do have a long-standing framework, body of work, in which I have been telling people that I thought the Federal Reserve, with its QE programs, was setting up the U.S. economy for a giant crash. So the thing you want to go to learn more about that is the Laura Murphy Report. It's what I write with my co-author, Carlos Lara. You can see the free sample issues and get the information on how to subscribe if you go to bobmurphyshow.com/LMR. Okay, so why don't we fast forward? I know you ended up on the Council of Economic Advisors. So why don't you tell the story? How did that happen? That's not something everybody does.
It relates to Sam Peltzman again. When Sam gave his talk, that kind of, which was a good talk, it wasn't like Leonovitz's talk at that orientation, he pitched how you might be able to become a summer intern at the Council of Economic Advisors. He'd been a senior economist there from 70 to 71. So he'd left just before the price controls, which came in August 15th, 71. And of course, he was really pissed about that. And so he made a pitch about how this might come along. Sometimes they're asked if they'll recommend students. So I went, whoa, that sounds kind of neat. And so, you know, I didn't know who I was in the sense like, am I in the bottom of the class? Am I in the top of the class? Like, where am I? And I figured out within a quarter or so that I was probably, I was in the top, say, 10%, maybe 15. So I was up there. And so when the opportunity came along, I applied and I got accepted. And so price controls were on. This was the summer of 73. It was kind of Watergate summer. Watergate had happened the previous summer. This was Watergate hearings summer. And I stayed in this house that these all these libertarians and conservative interns were renting. And I shared a bedroom with someone. And it was just real cheap because I wanted to save money. And I would ride my bicycle down the hill and go by all these people lined up at the Senate building where the hearings were. And I'd come into the White House thing with my shorts and my T-shirt and always piss off these Secret Service guys for showing such little respect. But I'd get into my office and change into my nice clothes. I didn't want to sweat into my nice clothes. Mm-hmm. So I just learned a ton. So what happened was, I didn't want to be involved in anything having to do with price controls. I wanted to do good economics. And I was pretty sure they weren't going to be analyzing price controls. And so my first day, I did a red eye all night long and went LA to Atlanta, Atlanta to DC. Oh, and by the way, just a little side thing. I slept so badly. And so George Hilton, who was my transportation professor, really good guy, eccentric as crazy, but really good guy. He and I traveled together and we took a cab together. He was going to the new executive office building. I was going to the old executive office building. So the cab stops at the new executive office building. I get out with my big suitcase and everything. And I look and there is a Soviet flag, like huge Soviet flag. I later found a picture of it in Time magazine, like decades later, over the old executive office building. And I'd slept so little that I went, oh my goodness, that they took over in the middle of the night. You know?
It's red dawn.
Yeah. And then I go, oh, no. People are just walking normally. And then I went, yeah, but remember the invasion of the body snatchers. And so I go and I give the Secret Service guy my name and he calls up and I said, hey, I just noticed that Soviet flag there. I mean, what's that about? And he goes, in this tone of this world-weary tone that I learned almost everyone in Washington had if they'd been there long enough, like, we're it and we know all about it, you know. Well, of course it's there because of the, you know, Brezhnev is visiting today. And then I went back to my invasion of the body snatchers model. And anyway, so I go up there and I'm really tired and no one's there to do anything with me. I just got put in an office, but no one's coming to me and saying, hey, we want you to do this. So I'm a kind of a take initiative kind of person. So I just walk up and down the halls and look at names on doors and see if I recognize them. And by the way, one name was Ron Hoffman, who later became a friend of mine. And he looked a lot like Dustin Hoffman. And years later, I was visiting him in DC, like 4 years later. And I said, are you related to Dustin Hoffman? He says, yeah, he's my brother.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Anyway, and he helped me find an immigration lawyer because I got in some immigration trouble that summer. But anyway, I see the name Robert Tollison, and I'd seen his name having to do with public choice stuff. So I knocked on his door, and I thought, I don't want to reveal myself too quickly. You know, who knows, right? But bit by bit, I kind of said, I think I said something like, what do you think of the price controls? And he said, they're horrible. Oh, great. You know, so I could kind of reveal who I was. And I said, I want to do everything I can to stay away from that. And he said, well, I'll get you as my research assistant and get into all my issues. Well, here was the neat thing. When he left about a month later, he was confident enough in me that he recommended to Herb Stein that I be able to fill in as an acting senior economist at age 22 until his replacement showed up a month later. And that was just such an incredible experience. I was going to meet with, I was the council representative, say, meeting with the undersecretary of transportation and all these other people at that level. And it was just really neat. And I remember that was another thing that convinced me I really was an economist. Mm-hmm. Because I remember this one argument I had when I was at the Secretary of Transportation's office. There was this chief economist of the Justice Department named George Hay. He was a Yale economist. Good guy. I liked him personally. And he was talking about how railroads shouldn't be able to, they should be controlled in their ability to use their own property, their own rails, and other people should just be given, other railroads should be able to be given the right to use their rails. And I learned very quickly, you don't make rights arguments. No one cares. Mm-hmm. But you do make economic arguments. And I said, well, then you got potentially the tragedy of the commons. What's the incentive to maintain the rail by the owner if everyone's just going to be able to use it and not pay a cost for that? And he looked just flustered. And I went, I didn't go like, you know, didn't drop the mic, to use your term. I see you use a lot. But internally, I dropped the mic. Internally, I went, oh, my goodness, like, I'm learning stuff at UCLA. You know, this is good. If I can beat a guy who's 10 to 15 years older than me and, you know, is the chief economist at the Justice Department on a pretty important issue, I'm learning something. So it's just those kinds of things. So then when I got a chance, so a friend of mine at Hoover, you know, when Reagan got elected, said, you know, you should, by this time I'm teaching at Santa Clara University, and there's a lot of stuff in between, including being at the Cato Institute in San Francisco. But he said, you know, you should be on the Council of Economic Advisors, you should be a senior economist this time, and it'll be a line in your resume that'll always be there, it'll be really helpful. And I thought, yeah, and plus I was there, I had way less diplomacy than I have now. I knew way less, I'm a way better writer. Like, everything will be great. And so when I found I was driving home from Santa Clara to San Francisco one afternoon when Reagan was president-elect, and I found out that Murray Weidenbaum was the chairman, well, I had defended Murray in this piece I'd done, this editorial I'd done in Policy Review when I was the editor of Policy Review at Cato, defended him and others who were proposing deregulation from a really scurrilous attack done by the Village Voice. My piece was titled Reply to the Voice. And I'd sent copies of my defense to everyone they'd attacked, including Murray. And I didn't do it strategically in the sense that you think of those things. It was just strategically in the sense of giving them moral support for what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And Murray remembered that. And so when I called him, he remembered me. And he said, yeah, when I get there, you know, I'll see if I can get you on as a senior economist. Well, he gets there and they're fighting about budget and tax policy and everything. So he had zero time to get in touch with me, which I understand. But I did get a job with John Cogan, who I'd known in graduate school and who was now at Hoover. He was an assistant secretary of labor. And I got to be one of his special assistants. And then I got invited over by Murray for an interview. And it went really well. And the person, by the way, who I got invited back to be re-interviewed, this is interesting, was Bill Niskanen. Like, I think he wasn't sold on me that first time. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I got the offer. And then, of course, Murray resigned. And I was supposed to show up in mid-August. And Murray resigned effective Labor Day. My girlfriend, who now is my wife, had moved from Santa Clara. We'd met when we were both teaching there, and we bought a house in Arlington. And I'd come back from the Labor Department on a Friday afternoon. We're going to take a week off, go on vacation before I start at the Council of Economic Advisors. And I get this call from Murray late on Friday. And he says, I just talked to Marty Feldstein, that was his replacement, and Marty has asked me to invite all of the people I've hired not to come. Well, I'd been at the Council of Economic Advisors as a summer intern, so I knew how the game was played. And I knew there was this gentleman's rule that you don't do that. If you've made commitments, the new guy keeps them. So I said, okay, thank you.
Hang on, let me stop you. Feldstein said he wanted to give the option that they don't have to come if they don't want to work for me, or he was basically saying, I want to hire my guys.
I want to hire my guys.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm inviting you not to come it's a polite way of saying, I don't want you.
Right. I got you.
And so I knew the gentleman's rule. And so I said, well, thank you, Murray. Please tell Marty I appreciate his invite and I respectfully reject it. So we had our nice week-long vacation up at Deep Creek Lake in Maryland and came back, and I showed up and I had a couple of weeks there to get ready for Marty. And and by the way, so I was given one task and I took on a second one. I was given the task of taking everything Marty had ever written and finding out gotcha things in it that Kennedy or others could ask to make to embarrass him at the hearings. And man, did I come up with better
Kennedy
gotchas.
Kennedy being Ted Kennedy?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And did I come up with better gotchas than Kennedy came up with? Kennedy went after, do you know your power bill? I went after, well, if you're right, if you're saying that it's worth an increase of 5 percentage points in unemployment to reduce inflation by 1.5 percentage points, is that what you're saying in this article? And by the way, that was what he was saying in the article. And so they never asked that.
It's funny. Yeah, I've had a thing where, I do a lot of work for the energy sector, as you're aware, and so there's like the DeSmog blog and, these groups that, keep tabs on the deniers like that in their worldview. Yeah. And they've done some hit pieces. I mean, I go and look at it. I'm like, oh, geez, I wrote crazier stuff than that. They didn't really look at my stuff.
Yeah, right. Right. So, but the other thing I did was I looked around and I think I had a sense that he was going to be hiring your favorite economist, Paul Krugman,
right,
and Larry Summers. And so I thought, well, those guys aren't health economists. I look who's here, those guys aren't health economists. And I'd always had this fascination with health economics, even though I'd written zero in the area. And so what I did was I boned up for like half a day on Marty and half a day on health economics. And so I would, read through the literature, Newhouse and Phelps and all these people. And I'd come up with like, why is this so? Why is this an institutional fact? So I'd call them up. And of course, it's a call from the Council of Economic Advisors. They take the call.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Newhouse, I'd said, well, how come, given that a 50-year-old employee is four times as expensive as a 20-year-old employee to insure, how come the employer charges them the same as their employee contribution? And he goes, good question. I've always wondered that too. And so it's like, hey, I'm on track because they're wondering the same things I'm wondering. So Marty has a meeting. He gets there day after Labor Day, and he calls a meeting of all the people at the council, every junior economist, every senior economist, every member, Bill Niskanen and Bill Poole, and also the secretaries and the statisticians. And we can all fit in a room that holds 30 people. And the way a future friend of mine, who was one of the seniors, described it and summarized it is, I'm Marty Feldstein, don't talk to the press. But after he'd done all that, then he said, I want to go around the room and just say your name and where you came from, your most immediate job you were at. And so they start at his end of the room and Krugman and Summers are there and they do their thing and they come down to my end. And I thought, I'm going to take this chance. So I said, David Henderson, Labor Department, and I want to be the health economist. And I remember Larry Summers grins and looks, whispers something in Krugman's ear. And it's like, they laugh, like, who is this rube, right? So, and actually Summers kind of knew me a little, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I get back to my office. And an hour later,
I get this call. Can I stop you? What's your age like compared to Krugman?
I'm slightly older. I was 31. Krugman probably would have been about 28, I think.
Oh, okay. So it's not like you were the young whippersnapper. You were older than he was.
No. Okay. But I thought of myself as, when you're 31, it doesn't seem that different from 28.
Sure.
Right?
Well, can I also ask you, because, obviously nowadays I know who Krugman is and everything, but at that point, was he like a whiz kid or was he just?
He was.
Okay.
He was. I had a friend from UCLA, and one thing I always liked about this friend, he was a year or two ahead of me, but he didn't, even though he was libertarian, he didn't get tribal. So when someone like Summers comes along and does something good, well, that's great. Someone like Krugman does something, that's great. So he visited me at the council shortly into my time there, and he sees, you know, Krugman over at another table at lunch, and he says, whoa, he did something real neat, you know, showing this monopolistic competition model in international trade. And I went, oh, that's kind of neat, you know. So I didn't start off in any way negative on Krugman. And I ended up not negative on Krugman after a year. Mm-hmm. I just thought he just seemed like not a social person. Whereas Larry was social. So Larry and I would have good discussions. And Larry didn't seem to have this idea that the UCLA people were like the hicks or whatever. Whereas I think Krugman did to some extent, although I might be reading a lot into a couple of things. But so I go back to my office and I get a call from Alice Williams, who's the secretary of the chairman of the Ken. And she had this great voice. She goes, the chairman would like to see you. So I go down to his office, and I'd seen Marty at a conference or two, and he'd given a talk at UCLA, and he kind of remembered me. And he says, I hear you're a health economist. And I thought, ooh, do not oversell this, because he was the world's premier health economist in the mid-60s. So I said, well, 2 weeks worth, but I'm a fast learner. He said, okay, you got it. So that's how I became the health economist.
Do you think if you had answered differently, he might have thought you were a BSer and dinged it? Or?
Well, I've always believed honesty is the best policy, unless, you know, Hitler's asking where the Jews are hidden. You know, like, you just be honest. That's really a good idea.
I like what you did, but I'm just curious. Yeah. Do you think he was just like, that's what he was asking to see, is this guy, you know, or like, in other words, if you had said, oh yeah, I know it all, man, do you think he would have asked you some obscure question follow-up to catch you bluffing, or?
I don't know. And see, as I said, because of my view of honesty, I didn't even think through that issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but you know, here's the thing. I liked Marty. I didn't like that job as much as I liked being the acting senior economist when I was 22, because Marty was so smart. He knew everything. So many of us, I'd say aside from Larry and Paul, almost everyone else was like a glorified research assistant. That was my take.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it paid really well. And then here's the thing. The special assistant to the chairman, that's what he's called at the time, came to me towards the end of about March of my first year, maybe April, and asked me if I wanted to stay another year with a big salary increase. And I was already being paid like way more than academia. And I said, yeah, you know, because A, it was really good money, and I was wanting to propose to my wife to be, and I was wanting to save for a house. And B, I could say, no, Marty didn't have to take me. Marty chose me. You know?
Right.
So that was that. Yeah. Oh, because you're involved in energy, I always had this fascination with energy. And I became an energy economist in the late 70s. I wrote something about how Nixon, Ford, and Carter made me into an energy economist because of price controls. I was tracking that issue with like crazy. I was writing about it. I wrote op-eds for the Wall Street Journal that they didn't publish. I gave talks, especially around the Northeast, on it. So that was the slot I really wanted, but Ben Zeiker had it, and he was very good. He was a fellow UCLA-er. And so Ben left, and I asked Marty and Bill Niskanen, could I take that slot as well? Because energy's winding down, and I think I can handle it too. And they said yes.
Well, that's something I wanted to ask you about. You mentioned how the economists in the Nixon administration were, you know, they didn't like look behind closed doors. They thought the price controls were stupid.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I've, as you know, you helped me with the paper, you know, doing research and stuff like that. I'll link to it, folks, in the show notes page. So this is BobMurphyShow.com/8 for the stuff that we might bring up here. A paper for the Journal of Private Enterprise on the price controls. And by the way, there's for those of you who just know, like, oh yeah, there were lines at the pump, and things were a lot more nuanced. There was a lot going on, especially like at the higher levels with price control on crude and so forth. But my research, it did seem like there weren't professional economists who were in favor of that stuff.
Right.
And yet they lingered for a long time. And so do you have any thoughts on, I guess a cynic might say, what's the point of having all these economists on staff when every one of them thinks this is a whole stupid program that doesn't even achieve the government's official objectives, and yet it takes a decade to get rid of the thing?
Well, do I have thoughts? Yeah, I think the thing that really made them last longer than usual was the so-called entitlement program. Mm-hmm. Because entitlement's not the way people think of that, like Social Security. But here's the thing. The domestic price that's allowed to be charged on so-called old oil is $4.25 a barrel. The world price is around $11 a barrel. So you got all these refiners who have access to the 425 because of long-term contracts. And then you got other refiners who have to buy world oil at the market price. And they're saying it's unfair, and it is unfair. So instead of saying, let's get rid of the price controls, they say, let's give the people who don't have those contracts an entitlement to a certain amount. And it basically ends up giving them an artificial incentive to demand imports and kind of equalizes everyone. But it also then kind of cements in these relationships that the refiners kind of like, and that therefore there's one less voice, one less group of voices arguing against it. And so that was a part of it. And so that was what was so refreshing about Reagan. Reagan saw that it was just a bad idea. I mean, Carter saw that it was bad too. So they passed this law in 1980, but the price of getting rid of phasing out price controls was the so-called windfall profits tax on oil, which wasn't a windfall profits tax at all. It was an excise tax on oil. And so it would have been a very expensive tax if the world price had remained high. And so it gave Reagan the discretion to end the controls. It gave whoever the president was discretion to end the controls. So he ended them his second week in office and ended them almost about 9 months before they would have legally expired. So he was really a breath of fresh air. And in fact, he'd chosen as his energy secretary that noted energy expert from North Carolina, Governor Edwards, whose profession had been dentistry. And at the first cabinet council meeting, when they're talking about this, Edwards has already gone native. That's the term we use in Washington. In other words, he's listened to his staff and they've said, no, well, we got to take our time. And so Reagan says, well, Jim, James Edwards, what do you say about this? And he says, well, Mr. President, it's complicated. And Reagan shoots back. This is a friend of mine who from OMB had been at the meeting in one of those seats at the back. And Reagan says to Jim Edwards, well, Jim, it better not be that complicated because I'm deciding tomorrow. And of course, he ended them. So,
yeah, just for context, especially for economists who are listening to this, the details, it's a fascinating study in just unintended consequences and how the government does one thing and then that causes problems and they, issue more regulations to deal with that. And then it pops up over here and it's whack-a-mole. That whole episode of the 1970s and the price controls on crude is great. And as David says, this entitlements program where it ended up implicitly subsidizing imports of foreign oil. Right?
Yeah.
You agree with that?
Yes, I do.
Which is just the whole point of this, ostensibly for the, what they were, how they were selling to the public was, we don't want to be reliant on OPEC. They got this embargo and did it. And yet this program they ended up putting in place ended up actually subsidizing and encouraging more imports than otherwise would have happened.
That's right. And during the academic year 74, 75, when I was supposed to be working on my thesis, my dissertation, I was trying to model this entitlements program and I kind of got it. The person who came along and really got it and did his dissertation on it was Joe Kalt, who then went to Harvard. But I remember I had some connections with some Treasury economists who were good on energy and a guy named Dick Sweeney, Richard Sweeney, who later went to those private school, Claremont, he had this piece he sent me, and I think he basically got it right, and it was titled Everyone Loses, and he just showed how this was just a horrible program.
And this is all, the outlines of this stuff, the main points are all in this paper that I'll link to, folks, because it's, again, part of the function of me writing it up was just with my work with Rob Bradley of the Institute for Energy Research, I knew there was a lot in this episode that even free market economists weren't aware of. And so I said, I got to write this up in a summary piece. But what was funny, I don't know if you remember this, David, that Milton Friedman, I think it was in his Newsweek column, he actually made one argument about something. And then one of his students privately told him that no, actually that was wrong because he didn't fully get the nuances of the entitlements program. And so then he had a follow-up column where he basically had to say this was wrong, but the way he spun it was like, the government's program's even crazier than I realized.
I absolutely do remember that because I was reading those columns in real time. You were a kid in Rochester and I was an economics professor in Rochester.
Well, since you brought up the fact that Krugman was there, and I maybe should have given you time to prep for this. I don't know if you remember the details off the top of your head, but one of the things I've used plenty of times when Krugman makes fun of people for getting inflation predictions wrong is it was just the gift that keeps on giving is you refer to a memo that did he write it or did he have his name on it? Or you know what I'm talking about, right?
He and Larry Summers wrote it. They wrote it, if I recall, in early September, which means days after they got there, there was an air of confidence in it.
September of what year?
Of 82, when they just started and I just started, mm-hmm. They'd been there a week and I'd been there 3 weeks. And I remember talking about it with Lincoln Anderson, who was a UCLA ABD, didn't finish his dissertation. He was kind of a macro guy, and Ben Zeiker. And we're going, really? Really? Because they were probably saying really because they thought, no way. I was saying really because I thought, probably no way. In other words, I guess they could be right, but this seems unlikely. And of course, it was so far off. They predicted that inflation, if I recall, they said, yeah, we got low inflation now, but it's going to go up by 4 to 5 percentage points. And of course, it didn't. It didn't come close.
Yeah. And they were using like a Keynesian framework, right?
That's right.
It was who they were writing it to.
Marty.
Okay. So in their capacity as being on the CEA, they're telling their boss, we think that, the price inflation. And so the context, and we go into this story too, since I brought it up, my most embarrassing professional moment and thing. But so the story, and I'll let David tell his version of what happened, is that David and I had this bet on consumer price inflation that I lost. And I had been betting that CPI would break 10%, year over year CPI would break 10%, and it didn't. And the irony is when Krugman wrote this memo saying that consumer price inflation was going to go up by 5 percentage points, something like that, whatever CPI was at the time. In other words, if Krugman's prediction had come true when they wrote this, and by the way, in the memo, it said something like inflationary time bomb.
It was something, some terminology.
Yeah,
I'm
not putting word, it was really provocative. Yeah. Like, I think they literally used the phrase inflationary time bomb.
I think they did.
And so if their prediction had come true at that time, CPI would have broken 10%. So it's the irony of, and so my only joke was at the time it would have been good if Krugman, on the CEA said to you, hey, I bet you $500 my memo turns out to be right. Then it would have been literally, we both lost a 10 percentage point inflation bet to David Henderson.
You know what though? Given that I was about to get married, or thinking I'm probably going to get married, we had just started living together, I probably would have taken that bet at 500.
Well, plus, that would have been a lot more money.
I would have done 100. Yeah. But,
So since I've gone ahead and brought up, why don't you, the backdrop is yes, that I, let me tell a little bit and then I'll have you give your version. Yeah. So I don't remember what year this was, but it was after, QE had been in place and people like me were freaking out about, Ben Bernanke, look what he's doing, and we're warning. By the way, just for people to know, I was saying that there are certain people using the phrase hyperinflation all the time. And, at some point I was saying, guys, unless the Fed just did even more, this isn't going to be hyperinflation. It's not going to be interwar Germany. So let's maybe not use that terminology. But yes, I thought there was going to be serious inflation, price inflation. And Brian Kaplan was the one who originally challenged me and said, well, what do you mean? Like, you just, let's be specific. And I said, okay, yeah, I get what you mean, that, just to walk, run around scaring people without being more specific. So he and I came up with to pin down a bet where I said, between this time and this time, and I think I had like a 5-year window or something, that I think there will be a 12-month span in which CPI goes up by at least 10%. And then you wanted in on that. So why don't you take over?
Right. Yeah. And so I thought inflation would go up. I knew what you were looking at. You were looking at the money supply data. And if history was any guide, there was a lot to what you said. But remember, money demand was going up too. And so I thought 10%, there's a lot of room between where we are now and 10%. And I would bet you that amount of money with those even odds at anything over 7. If you'd said 6, I'd say, I'm not so sure. Of course, we didn't even hit close to 6. But And also, I did what Brian did. I looked at TIPS, the Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, and the market. Then you can look at the difference between what the interest rate is on TIPS, which is a real rate, and the interest on normal Treasury bonds, which is a nominal rate, and that gives you the market's estimate. And the market's estimate, I think, was like 2 or 3% inflation. So I thought, you know, this is a sure bet. Like, not a sure bet, obviously, but these are really good odds. So that's why I took it.
And you increased the amount too. I think Brian and I bet 100 and you wanted 500.
Yeah. Like, Brian and I have somewhat different motives. One motive we both have, it's not a bad motive at all. It's to try to teach the other person. And I'm sorry if that sounds really condescending, but I wanted to teach you, you know, not just to be a little more careful. And, but the other motive is, as I've always said, and Brian never says this, I think betting is just pure fun. It's kind of like my version of Vegas. I don't enjoy going to Vegas. And I mean, I enjoy going to Vegas, but it's to see that show at Bellagio, you know, the free show. Mm-hmm. I don't like betting at gambling tables, but I do like betting on things I know something about. It's just fun. And I lost 2 bets, by the way, in the midterm elections just in the last month, you know, because I wanted to.
So someone taught you a lesson?
Yeah. Look at data more carefully. Like, so I bet that the Democrats wouldn't win the House. And then I bet someone else later, when I started thinking that was a bad bet, I bet someone else that they wouldn't win more than 30 seats. And I lost.
Huh. Yeah. Just to bookend that. So the thing that's really funny, and we don't need to get bogged down because I've talked elsewhere, and I'll put in the show notes page, folks, links to the inflation stuff. But what was so funny about that is Krugman and DeLong. I really think DeLong like put it on his calendar or something for when, because he blogged like right before the official timeline that I had with you for our bet, David. Yeah. And it was doing victory laps, of course. And so then Krugman saw that and picked it up. And their response, which won't shock, I'm sure, many of our listeners here, because a lot of them are come over from Contra Krugman, was that, yeah, Murphy's an ideologue. He made a bet based on his model. He got it wrong. Therefore, his model's wrong. And yet he clings to his worldview. So clearly, this guy's an ideologue. He doesn't respond to data. And so what was weird to me in that was the person to whom I lost the bet also was against stimulus packages. And, you know, you were pro-austerity. Yeah. You had just done a piece for Mercatus about, like, the Canadian experience on, you know, cutting spending and stuff and how it didn't hurt. So that was weird to me. So my joke was, when I lose the bet to Brian, or if he loses to me, either way, they can conclude, therefore, anarcho-capitalism is wrong because, you know, anarcho-capitalist lost a bet. So
Right. On the other hand, they could conclude in the bet between you and Brian, anarcho-capitalism is right.
Yeah, because it's worldview generated a correct prediction. Right, exactly.
Right. That was so weird because they didn't want to get into those details because it then wouldn't have fit their narrative.
So since I brought it up, why don't you, just for people who don't know, that the Canadian, you know what I'm talking about, right? That Mercatus piece.
Yes.
I think people would be surprised to learn that it's the Canadian experience of the mid to late 90s and what they did with their budget, just the big picture for those who aren't aware of it.
Yeah. I just, one day, I'm trying to think how I saw this. I was just looking at some data on Canada and their government spending as a percent of GDP and just how it had fallen. I'm saying, oh my goodness, I come from Canada. I grew up in Canada. I thought I was paying close attention to Canadian politics. I always hated the Liberal Party. I didn't like the Liberal Party. I really didn't like Trudeau, who got us, the older Trudeau, who got us into a lot of the troubles we were in. So to find out that two of his closest allies, Prime Minister Jean Chrétien and the Finance Minister, Paul, and his name isn't coming to me. He later became Prime Minister. Anyway, it'll come. That they were like the heroes in this. It's like, wow, this is too good a story not to tell. And it's an especially important story to tell because people are showing such despair at cutting the U.S. budget. And so I just went and looked at the data and got a deal with Mercatus. It was one of the funnest projects I've ever worked on. And part of what's fun is to come across people who you thought, I'm a glass half full kind of person almost all the time. So to come across people who I thought were villains who turned out to be almost heroes, that was kind of neat, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And so they cut their government spending as a percent of GDP Oh, first of all, the Canadian government relative to GDP isn't typically as large as the American government, and that's for two reasons. The provincial governments are more powerful and do a number of things that the federal government doesn't do much of. One of the big examples being education. The federal government's budget on education is $0. They don't do education. The other reason, of course, is not as large a military establishment. And then, of course, things like Medicare, their socialized medical system, are almost entirely provincial responsibilities, even though they're regulated by the feds. So anyway, they took, I don't have these numbers handy, but I think at one point they brought down federal government spending from around 17% of GDP to around 11% of GDP. And then it crept back up, but it was some incredible drop like that. And that was just too good a story not to tell. And so I told it.
Yeah. And like you say, folks, we'll put links at the show notes page if you want to see the details, but it really was like they truly reduced government spending. It wasn't just that they slowed the rate of growth.
Yep.
And they went from being having a big deficit to having a string of surpluses. I remember that, you know, the figure of government debt as a percentage of GDP just fell off a cliff.
Yep.
And the whole thing was the reason it was so relevant for when you wrote this up, you know, this was in the midst of the, you know, debates over stimulus and austerity in the U.S., in the, you know, the wake of the 2008 crisis, that they had been, you know, in a weak economy and they had to do it for fiscal reasons. Like there was a concern that Canadian debt was going to get downgraded significantly. And so they had to cut spending. And so in the Keynesian world where you would have thought, oh, that should plunge them into a really bad depression. And, you know, nothing bad like that did happen. So
that's right.
It was a
that's
great counterexample. And what's funny, let me do a quick plug, folks, for my book on Krugman. So go to ContraKrugmanBook.com to get it. I write this all up, but Krugman at the time kept complaining about what he called the Canadian cockroach, meaning this cockroach idea that Canada from the late 1990s has any relevance to what's going on now in the U.S., you know, in these talks. And then I dug up a Krugman column where he had said that Canada in the late 1990s actually provides a good model for what should guide us today. Like, so,
oh, wow. Yeah,
it was just kind of,
wow.
Now, of course, they were for different reasons, you know what I mean? Another, yeah. But it was funny that when, you know, right winger types tried to point to that as an example of how you could cut spending and doesn't hurt anything, he said, oh, come on, that's clearly not a good model. And yet, for whatever reason, he thought it was worthy of study. It was a great illustration of how we should conduct ourselves. So, I mean, it's, yeah. I want to say it wasn't just a contradiction with a K, it was a literal C contradiction.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And so it's just a great story. And then after I did that for Mercatus, I thought, well, you know, I remember reading something about the American data after World War II, and that was an even more impressive accomplishment than what they did in Canada. Paul Martin, that was his name, Paul Martin, the finance minister, was later prime minister. And so in the United States, to give you an idea of how much they cut, because those numbers don't mean much today, but if they cut government spending by the same number of percentage points of GDP today, they would have cut all government spending. So they cut from around government spending around 45% of GDP in 1944, the peak year. This is just federal government, mm-hmm. to government spending around 15% of GDP or a little less. So 30 percentage points, that would be like cutting the federal government by $6 trillion a year. The federal government is only about $4.5 trillion a year. So it's just huge. And of course, they had a boom. And that, again, just conflicted with this whole Keynesian view of the world. And in my study for Mercatus, I quoted various Keynesians like Gunnar Myrdal, who later co-won the Nobel Prize with Hayek, and Paul Samuelson, worrying about this huge, huge depression we would have after World War II.
And there's been some revisionism or revision of the revisionism where I've seen Keynesians saying, oh, no Keynesian thought that there was going to be a depression again. And maybe they produced like one guy who did say that back then, you know, in other words, didn't think there was going to be a resumption of the depression. But yeah, there clearly is your piece, and I've seen other examples demonstrate there were, and why wouldn't they? If,
right.
if the government spending got us out of the depression and then all of a sudden they just take it away in 1 year, why wouldn't you think that might bring a return of the depression? I mean, that kind of makes sense.
Right, exactly, right. I mean, their own model would have said it. So you'd be surprised to see Keynesians just giving up on their own model without, you know, without looking. Well, they could look at the data, but giving up on their own model.
Right. Let's take a break from my conversation with David to mention my book on Paul Krugman. This issue has come up during a conversation, but I have hundreds of pages detailing all of the things that Paul Krugman has said over the years and the ways in which he's just demonstrably wrong and, in fact, often contradicts stuff that he himself has written earlier. And all that stuff is available. It's great stuff. Go to ContraKrugmanBook.com for more information to see how you can order it. It makes a great Christmas present. Once again, that's ContraKrugmanBook.com. Well, why don't we switch gears now, David, and another big component of your online career, at least, and how I think a lot of my listeners may have heard of you, is that you wrote a lot, and I don't know if you're still doing this, for antiwar.com. So can you give us the backstory? You know, how did you get affiliated with them?
Yes. So I taught at the Naval Postgraduate School from 1984 to 2017. So I taught military officers, mainly from the United States, but also from other countries. And I just thought, you know, here I am teaching warriors, and I don't know much about war. And so I just started reading a little on the side. Now, granted, I'm a libertarian. And so I thought, does it really make sense that government does so much better in foreign policy than it does in domestic policy when it knows even less? And I thought, no, probably not. But still, I'd been a big believer that the U.S. should have fought World War II. And I was always thinking it was a bad idea to fight World War I. It partly led to World War II. But World War II was the tough one. And so anyway, I took a sabbatical in 1999 and 2000 to study that. And I never came up with the slam dunk argument against getting involved in World War II. But it certainly got me to the position that I think it probably would have been a good idea not to get involved. And especially for the United States, because we had these two really great bodies of water protecting us called the Atlantic and the Pacific. And so anyway, I gave a talk. Oh, but back to 1990, when I was a year away from coming up for tenure, so this was a very risky thing to do. At least that's how I thought of it. It turned out it wasn't risky at all, but who knew? I wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal saying why we didn't need to go to war for oil. Because if you look at how President Bush, the one who just died, and Henry Kissinger and Secretary of State James Baker were talking, they were saying, if Saddam Hussein holds onto this oil and even gets more aggressive and takes over Saudi Arabia, he can just throw the world economy into a deep recession. And I just said, okay, let's take worst case. He takes every country but Iran. He hadn't been able to defeat Iran. And he cuts output of those countries by a third, which just seems like an overestimate. The loss in our GDP would be on the order of 0.5% per year, which is a big number, but not huge recession. And so I wrote that up. And by the way, my editor in that, who was a very good editor, was David Frum, who favored that war, but he was a good editor. And so it got on the
Wall Street Journal. He was the editor at the Wall Street Journal?
He was the editor on my piece. He was assigned to edit my piece. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And fellow Canadian. And so anyway, it got me on CNN live around the world, and Bobby Batista interviewed me, and I got some support from my provost. I didn't use my affiliation on the piece. I was nervous about that for the Navy school, but when I asked permission to use it in the interview, he said, not only may you, but kudos. So that was interesting. I learned a lot about academic freedom here. So anyway, that I did that piece, and then years later, I kind of updated it for the 2003 war. And I gave a talk at a barbecue locally, and Eric Garris, who's the managing editor of antiwar.com, was there. And he said, could you start writing for us? And it wasn't really good money, but I was really passionate about the issues. And so I started writing twice a month, and then it went down to once a month. And then other opportunities came along that were more lucrative. So it's kind of once in a while now. But it was a great, great experience to write that stuff and learn more. Because when you write it, you just want to be careful and you want to check your facts. And so I learned a lot just writing those things. So that was a really important part of my work. And I now that I'm retired, might have a little more time to go back to that.
Well, that's interesting. And correct me if you disagree, but I get the sense that military people, they certainly wouldn't like it if you got up there and called them, you know, baby killers or something, or questioned their motives.
Yeah.
But if you say something like, you know, I'm not sure it's wise to send our troops into this area of the world for these reasons, I think they kind of appreciate that, especially if what you're saying makes sense.
Many of them do. And I got to say that with all the stories I've heard about, you know, students who are 20 years old or whatever at civilian schools, I got to say, I sure never had that. Like, I had people who argued vociferously. They were never disrespectful. I never disrespected them. We just had great arguments. But I had some who really did change the views as a result of it. And none of them, I don't even think it would have occurred to them to call me unpatriotic. I literally don't think that would have occurred to maybe the odd person like once every few years, but pretty much not. You know, they understood I care about my country. That's one. I care about other countries too. So they're actually in a given war, two reasons. One is my country. The other is the other country, you know, not to go to war. But yeah, so that it worked out fine. I will tell you one thing I did though, which, it was kind of ultimately ended up quite good. But I was using Harvey Rosen's public finance text for a course on cost-benefit analysis and policy analysis. And the opening chapter is a very interesting chapter because he talks about views of government. He talks about the mechanistic view, which is government is there to do certain things, and that's just what it is. It's a mechanism, versus the organic view that says it's like Mao, and he even quotes Mao and Lenin and so on. And we're just, you know, you, Bob Murphy, are a little cell in the arm of the society, and government is the brain. And I said, you know, which do you think applies to the United States? And they say, which is my answer to pretty much the mechanistic view. I said, that's true. But if you look at our language has a lot of the organic view. So for example, people will say, we invaded Iraq. And then I just did this off the top of my head. I said, I didn't invade Iraq. Maybe some of you invaded Iraq. Oh my God. So that got pretty intense. And then I said, you know, well, read this article I wrote on antiwar.com, which I never put in my bio I handed out the first day. I said, read this article titled, Who Is We? It's one of my favorite articles, one of my first ones I did. Anyway, we just had such an intense discussion. I was talking to my co-author, Charlie Hooper, that night at this talk we were giving. And he said, wow, this is what academia is supposed to be. And I thought, yeah, you're right. So I wrote up the discussion and I tried to disguise what people said by you know, because some of them emailed me afterwards and tried to disguise because one was a foreign officer. But they came to class, and I put it on antiwar.com, and they came to class the next week, and some of them were really pissed. This foreign officer asked me, I said, look, it's online. I can change it. Do you want me to go online and get rid of the quotes where I reference you? And she said, yes. And I said, okay. So I did. But
they weren't mad at your position. They were mad that you had quoted.
Yeah. And I understand that. I understand that because I think they were right. I think what happens in class is sacred. It's like the Chatham House rule, you know, it doesn't, or like the Vegas rule, you know, what happens there stays there. And so I think they were right. And so I never did that again. But the next week,
you didn't name anybody. You just said one student said.
I would have never done right. that. I was too, yeah,
I just
too
want
smart
our
to do
listeners
that.
To realize it's yeah. a minor, you know, judgment yeah. call. Should you not have done? But yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So the next week, the liaison officer, he's the guy when students have a beef with a professor, he'll show up and talk to you. And that means it escalated in a way I wasn't happy about. And he came, I got to school and he's waiting outside my office and I invited him in and he's a good guy. He later was a student of mine in an energy course I taught. But anyway, he said, look, I'm just here as a messenger. So please understand these aren't my views. But a student came to me and said, and a student in your class came to me and said, what is Professor Henderson doing writing on something called antiwar.com and taking a check from the Department of Defense? And then the student had said to him, I hasten to add that I don't necessarily disagree with anything he said. But he was pissed. He was pissed. Mm-hmm. And so I said to the liaison officer, so I'm curious, how did you answer? He said, I think it's something called the First Amendment. which is a pretty damn good answer, right? Because we are a federal facility. So we talked it out, and that was that. So I'm pretty sure I know who the guy was. I mean, I don't remember his name now, but I've got all my grades. I probably could remember. But I'm not someone who takes, you know, vengeance. I just thought, okay, I'd be a little careful with him, you know. So anyway, my student opinion forms come out, and they come out well after I've assigned the grades. So there's nothing that can be done. And, you know, the highest they can rate you is 5, and the lowest is 1. And this particular class had 21 students in it. I often got between 4.4 and 4.8, and those were high at the time relative to the average, although there's been some grade inflation on that end too, the way the students grade the professors. This is the first time I've had a class with more than 10 people, and I think I had 21, in which my average in the overall rating was 5.0. So to me, it was like, wow, you can talk about this stuff, they will process it, and they won't hold it against you. You know, so that was just, that was, I kind of wept when I read those numbers.
Well, to me, that doesn't surprise me. I mean, I wouldn't have known that it would be the whole class, but that doesn't surprise me as much, because I think, you know, if you're sincere, and you clearly are, that the students appreciate that, that they know this guy, you know, he's not BSing us.
Yeah.
But I'm more impressed that the Naval Postgraduate School was, you know, do you know, like, is it the kind of thing where they would have preferred you weren't doing that, or they really like, no, that's great, do it, you know?
Well, it would depend on the person. It's like anything. It's like when people talk about China. And you know,
there is what no are the Chinese. It's individuals. Right, yeah.
What do the Chinese think, you know? And it's like different people have different views. So when I took on Leon Panetta, he had just been appointed, you know, Secretary of Defense. I had a colleague who's a very good friend of mine tell me that I was out of line for taking him on. He said, you should save that for another venue. I said, what venue? When do we ever get to talk?
Well, can you tell that story too? I mean, you can finish.
Yeah, I'm done in the other one. So Leon shows up, and what I did, there are these things called
Clinton administration?
No, the Obama administration, because he went from CIA to DOD.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And so this was not that long ago. And it's like Local Boy Makes Good. He'd been our congressman, you know, in the 80s and everything. And Local Boy Makes Good. So you don't ask tough questions. That I guess that's what many people think. That's not what I think. And you just ask respectfully. So what's the problem? So I always, when I thought I might ask a question, sat right by the microphone. So when they say question time, I'm the first or second questioner, depending on who got up quickly at the microphone on the other side of the room. And I just told him who I was. I quoted from an article by Mueller, that political scientist at Ohio State, saying that some computer they'd found that was owned by Al-Qaeda found that their overall budget for chemical weapons was somewhere on the order of $4,000 a year. And so I said, quoted that, and I said, in light of that fact, in light of what you said earlier, that when you were at CIA, that there are only maybe 24 Al-Qaeda operatives left, and in light of the budget deficit that you so eloquently laid out, when do you say enough is enough? Let's get out. Let's end this war. And Leon, so I told a friend about this, and it's online, and you can find it. I can send you the link.
Yeah, we'll definitely put that up.
And so I told a friend who lived out where there wasn't good connections. So you'd watch 5 seconds of Leon. This is the first time I'd seen it. You'd watch 5 seconds of Leon, and then you'd wait, and you'd watch 5 seconds more, and you see his hands getting tight around the lectern. It was way more effective than watching it with no pauses. And he did a total Dick Cheney, like, we will not stop until the people who hate us and want to kill us are all gone. You know, so we won't stop, right?
Right.
And so anyway, the local reporter in the Monterey Herald reported it accurately, reported my question that I had asked, and reported in short form, and reported accurately in short form Leon's answer. And so I wrote to the Herald, and it got published the next day, saying I was the person who asked the question. I made sure I didn't identify myself as a professor because I wanted to follow their rules about, you know, media. And I just want to point out, you quoted the question and the answer accurately. And so what Panetta is saying is we are never going to end this war. I just want to point that out. Mm-hmm. And so far, that's a bet I'm winning, you know, so yeah. But that was quite striking.
Well, the last thing I want to just ask you about, David, is I know you have a few books, well, two books that you have out that you were the co-author of. So I'm wondering, can you just explain to our listeners what they are? And, you know, just so if yes. they're curious, they might pick them up.
Yes. So the first one I wrote as opposed to edited was in 2001, The Joy of Freedom, An Economist's Odyssey. And I've been thinking about this book since roughly the early 90s, because even though I loved Milton and Rose Friedman's book, Free to Choose, the subtitle was A Personal Statement. I've read the book at least twice. I've read parts of it three or four times to prep little seminars for students. There's nothing personal in there whatsoever.
That's a good point. Yeah, I never thought about that. Why did I do that?
And so I thought, what would a personal statement be? What's my story? And I'd been teaching some Institute for Humane Studies seminars and so on. And it was really fun talking to students. How did you come to your views? Because there's incredible diversity. Well, I read this thing. Phil Magnus, if you ask him, how'd you come to your views? This person at an airport when he was 12 confiscated this toy sword he had so he could get on the airplane. And he's still pissed about that.
Right? It comes out on social media.
Yeah, right.
Was the guy an adjunct professor?
Yeah, right. That might be too much of an in-joke, but I don't know your audience. But anyway, you might have to link to something. But anyway, so I thought, well, I think I've got a fairly interesting story about how I've come to my views and why I believe in them. And it's not just all economics. Chapter 2 is titled Hooked in Economics, and it tells the story that I told earlier about this. And in fact, if you want, I could send you a PDF of that if that might help your listeners. Anyway, so I did that, and it's still one of my proudest accomplishments. I think I'll be known after I die, if I die in the next 15 years. I'll be known for the Concise Encyclopedia of Economics, and that makes sense. It's probably the most valuable thing I've done publishing-wise. But the one I'm proudest of is The Joy of Freedom, An Economist's Odyssey. And then I had a student at Santa Clara back in 1980 who was just one of my best students and one of my favorite people. And we later connected up around the mid-80s. We kind of lost touch, and then about 5 or 6 years later connected up. And he would tell me stories about his consulting world and just dumb decisions being made where a little economics or a little common sense or a little decision theory would have gone a long way. And then every once in a while, a really good decision where they did use those tools. And I had similar stories. And we thought of writing a book, so we wrote this book titled Making Great Decisions in Business and Life. And we just lay out some basic principles, but we kind of tell the story first. So what principle did this violate, or what principle did this apply? And so that's one out there. And of course, those are both available on the web, Joy of Freedom and Making Great Decisions. So yeah, that's that. And of course, then the other thing I really am proud of is the Encyclopedia of Economics.
Yes, and we'll put links to all that stuff at bobmurphyshow.com/8. Let me ask you on the making decisions, and I won't say who it is because I don't want to embarrass the person or, you know, have them get in trouble. But somebody I knew that I know very well was telling me one time that he was sitting around a table when a major decision was going to be made at the company where he was working, and it involved, like, they had to replace a machine, and the issue was it was down to two types. And one was going to cost a lot more up front, but it was going to require, you know, fewer workers or something. You know, it was going to be cheaper to operate over the lifespan, but it was a higher upfront cost. And the other one was cheaper to get, but, you know, the expenses were higher. And so he was saying, and the way they were trying, he was explaining to me how they were trying to solve it. And he said, it seemed like it's missing. And so I brought up, I was like, well, you know, it matters what, you know, what's the interest rate, what discount rate are they using?
Right.
And he was saying, you know, they didn't talk about that. And I was, yes. And I said, wait a minute, are you sure? And this, it was a bigger company. It wasn't like a mom and pop operation. Yeah. And he said there were like guys from accounting and stuff in there. And so, and I was wondering, you know, and I was telling to him, are you sure like just that wasn't so obvious that they weren't bringing up the details, but that, and he was saying, well, all I can tell you is what the discussion was as we were making this decision. And I'm telling you, nobody brought up interest rates at all.
Yeah.
And I'm just, does that sound plausible to you?
It sounds totally plausible. We don't have a story like that in our book, but I have a story like that on the blog. I have a whole lot of my retirement assets in Vanguard. I love Vanguard. So I get these little announcements of various things, and every once in a while I look at them. And there's this thing they sent out when I was trying to decide when to take Social Security. I'd already made my decision. I think I made a good decision. But they had their own way of looking at it. I thought, well, I'll see what they're saying. It might make a good blog post. It made a good blog post, but not in the way I expected. They were looking at whether you take it, say, at age 66, 67, 68, 69, or 70, and they used a zero discount rate explicitly, a zero interest rate. It's stunning. This is this isn't a mom and pop company. Mm-hmm. This is the premier financial retirement investment company in the United States, which probably makes it premier in the world. And like John Bogle, who started, who's a great guy, by the way, I had a really fun correspondence with him about a piece I wrote in the journal. I don't think he ever would have done this, but some of the people they hired do this.
Well, and it just goes to show you the importance of thinking like an economist.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Well, with that, why don't we wrap up? I know there's plenty more we could talk about, but we'll end here. And thank you for your time, David. I'm sure the listeners enjoyed all of your tales.
Thank you.
And maybe I'll be in touch down the road and we'll have you back.
That would be great. Thank you.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.